Previously, with Martin Bester.
My pleasure to welcome back on the show Professor Salim Abdul Karim, Director at CAPRISA and Professor of Global Health at Columbia University. Always good to catch up with you. Good Professor, how are you? Good morning.
A very good morning, Martin, and good morning to all of the listeners.
Lots of questions coming in for you this morning. Obviously, I think COVID-19, you know, it comes and goes off our radar. It's always been there, obviously, since early last year. But very much back on the radar with all this talks about a third wave and possibly more lockdowns. Where are we with the third wave? I know that it was confirmed for, I think, the Free State and Gauteng, possibly.
Yeah, when we look at the overall situation in South Africa, we are now on a seven-day moving average, somewhere between 2,000 and 2,500 cases per day on average. Now, when we've hit that sort of number in the first and second waves, our doubling time was about 14 days.
Okay.
So that means that based on where we are now, in about 2 weeks' time, if the third wave trajectory follows either the first or the second wave, that we can expect to be at around 4,000 to 5,000 cases in 2 weeks' time. So that is a concern. And it's being driven at this point by about three or four provinces. And if that continues, we could be then going, you know, very firmly into our third wave. I think the evidence points now that we are in the trajectory of the third wave.
Are there countries that show that a third wave can be prevented or that it's lower and smaller than expected? I mean, could we be surprised that it doesn't follow the same trajectory as wave one and two?
Well, I think the one thing we've learned with this virus is the moment you think it's X, it will actually do Y. So it's very hard to predict. But let's look at what do we know. We know that between the first and second waves, it took about 3 months, and it took about the same time between our second wave and the current rise in cases that we're seeing. The second is, when we look at other countries, there have been a handful that have had third waves. Most of them, the third waves were more severe than the first or second waves. So it is a concerning situation. Now, our situation is different from those countries because we had a variant in our second wave. So we can expect our third wave to be somewhat different.
Okay.
Is it really going to be less severe, or how much less severe? Difficult to tell.
So obviously the differentiating factor here could also, the big role player would be the vaccines.
Yeah, so we're not really going to make much difference to the third wave with vaccines. In fact, very few countries in the world can do that, because you have to get to around 70%, 80% coverage before, to make an impact. To avoid a third wave is very difficult with vaccines. So we're going to have to use a combination of things. And principally, they will involve restrictions, some behavior change, some vaccination. So in combination with that, plus our past infection immunity, I think we're likely to use all of those to try and curb the trajectory of the third wave.
Does winter play a role? Does it make it better or worse?
You know, it's not really the temperature that seems to matter that much. Rather, it's our behavior in response to temperature. So what happens in, and that's pretty much happening now in Gauteng, because it's so cold at night, people are, closing the windows, they are putting their heating on, and now you've got a whole lot of people in one room breathing the same air, and that's what creates the conditions for this virus to spread. So it's not the temperature, but because of our behavior in winter, it seems to be impacting the risk of the spread of the virus.
Now, just talking about vaccines, there seems to be another holdup. I mean, obviously, our government could have done better with the rollout, I think, even in their own estimation, when it comes to our vaccines. What are your thoughts about it?
You know, vaccines are a real challenge because, there are 8 billion people in the world, and there's only been, about 1.4 billion vaccinations, doses available so far. So you know, there is a huge mismatch between demand and supply. And when we look at, you know, where have the first billion vaccines gone to, they have gone predominantly to four countries. And those four countries had access to vaccines because they made vaccines. So they were the USA, the UK, Russia, and China. They have the bulk of the doses. So that means for other countries like ourselves that didn't actually make our own vaccines and didn't engage in either development of vaccines or manufacturing of vaccines, we have to join the queue. We have to stand in the queue and say, you know, we'd like to buy vaccines. Please, please give us some vaccines. And that's always going to be a challenge. We were never going to be at the front of the queue in that situation.
Well, now talking about America, I see their President Joe Biden, I saw it earlier this morning on Twitter, he said that they pretty much now reached kind of herd immunity. They vaccinated the country, and now the vaccines they're going to pass on to other countries. I think the first shipment will be like 80 million. I don't know where he's sending it to, but that's the good news from those countries you just mentioned now. Once they're vaccinated on their side, they will then share with the rest of us.
Yeah, you know, the situation in the U.S. is a little bit more complicated because they've only vaccinated with, you know, fully vaccinated, something like about 36-37% of the population. Oh. So it's not that high. Oh. But they've got over 50%. Now it's close to 60% that have had one dose. So based on that, they're now easing some of their restrictions around mask wearing and so on. So it's a bit touchy as to whether this is, you know, whether it's too early or not, and time will tell. But the doses that the U.S. is sending out is that they had huge stockpiles. They had 100 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. And it's not a vaccine that they've licensed, and they're probably not going to use it because they don't have confidence in it. So that's the vaccine that they're shipping around. And they've already sent some of the AstraZeneca vaccines to Mexico and to Canada.
Right.
And now they're sending some to India and other places.
Good time for this question then.
I'm very skeptical about taking the vaccine for COVID-19. And reason being is that I've heard that, you know, there are some bad side effects and that some people have passed away from taking the vaccine. My question is it safe to take the vaccine?
Professor?
So I think, put very simply, yes, the vaccine is safe. If we look at the current evidence, we find that all of these vaccines are exceptionally safe. They are in the same bracket of safety as we have with our childhood vaccines like measles and so on. There is no reason to be concerned. However, if people are concerned about some side effects, they should talk to their doctor, they should talk to their nurse, understand what those risks are. If the vaccine works, it must cause some side effects. You must expect to get a bit of a temperature, a bit of muscle pain. That's par for the course. It means that your immune response is working. And just think about it, that you're getting those mild side effects that only last for about a day or two. What if you had COVID? And imagine that situation where you'd be in hospital in reasonable likelihood and needing ventilation. So which would you rather have? I would say any day, take the vaccine, you know, put up with the small headache and a bit of chills.
Question about the antibodies efficacy. Just listen to this.
I just wanted to know, with this new variant from India that's now found in South Africa, I had COVID over Christmas and I was told that I have antibodies. Will it be effective against this new variant? And is this new variant more serious than the one we experienced during the second wave?
So two questions there. Let's, I think, start with the antibodies question.
Yes. So what we know about the antibodies is that when you've been infected with the variant that's been transmitted in South Africa, which we call the 501YV2 variant, it produces pretty good antibodies that protect against a whole range of different viruses.
Okay.
The challenge, however, is for those individuals who've had very mild COVID, the antibodies rapidly wane. So within a matter of, you know, 3-4 months, the antibodies you've had are now at a very low level. Mm. For those who've had severe COVID, their antibodies remain for a long time at pretty high levels. Uh-huh. So your antibody levels wane, and so they may not be protective. However, if you do have high antibody levels against the 501YV2, they are very likely to protect against the variant spreading in India called the B1617.
So would you say then on to that, would it be wise to go for an antibody test? If you had COVID like on Christmas, would you go for it now to see where your antibodies are?
No. I think most people who are going for antibody tests are not clear about what it means and how it's going to help you. It's useful insofar as trying to understand whether you've had exposure to the virus in the past.
Okay.
The problem is that because the antibody levels wane, the test may be positive today, but in 6 weeks from now may be negative. So you can't really interpret what that means if it's a negative result. A positive result is a little bit more informative, but a negative result, you can't really know what it means.
Just listening to that lady say that she had COVID in Christmas and she had variant 2, which is my case as well. And the one thing that's definitely lingered with me, and I hear a lot of people moaning about it, is how it affects your smell and your taste. That seems to be, whether you had mild COVID or serious COVID, that seems to be a symptom or an after effect that really lingers. Have you heard that?
Yeah, so we now have a better idea about the long-term course of this disease. And for those who've had mild COVID or just minimal symptoms, loss of taste and loss of smell are common. Yeah. The challenge with when you've had both those or either of those, it takes quite long to recover. Mm-hmm. However, the good news is that almost everybody recovers their full functionality of smell and of taste. But it takes long, so don't get panicked about it.
Okay. Last two questions. This one, I think you may have faced this question before.
Is this COVID thing a man-made disease or what? I've heard so many people say that it's been man-made and was, implemented that way.
I think it's the million-dollar question. What do we know about it now?
Yeah, so the World Health Organization has looked into that, and there have been various researchers that have been looking into this issue. I think on the current evidence we have, it would be very, very, very unlikely that this is a man-made virus. And the reason for that is that the actual sequences, the probability of coming up with a virus like this would take very long. And if I was making a virus that would cause a pandemic, I wouldn't choose coronavirus. It's too complicated to work with, 30,000 base pairs. So all of those things indicate that it's very unlikely, that the most likely situation, and the reason that there's evidence for that, is that it comes from bats. The SARS-CoV-1 and MERS both came from bats, and bats have a virus that's very similar to this. In addition, we found that in pangolins in China, that they have a virus also very similar to this. So we, based on all of the current, what we call circumstantial evidence, if you had to piece it together, the likely scenario is a bat virus infected a pangolin, probably in the seafood market in Wuhan, and that's how it became a human virus.
It sounds to me, listening to all that and what we know about it before as well, that the world needs to change its relationship with meat consumption.
You're absolutely right. And it's not just meat consumption. The world needs to decide how it's going to live with animals, because we are, as humanity, expanding our footprint on the earth, and we are encroaching on the animals' habitat. And so we must expect that we are going to find ourselves in a situation where animals have much closer interaction with us, and that we're going to pick up viruses and other bacteria from these animals.
Correct. Whether you like that conversation or not, 2020 and 2021 is forcing us to relook and rethink our relationship and our proximity and how we treat and deal with animals, not only in consumption, but as you say, in terms of living conditions, because that's where these viruses come from. It's the world is sick, and it's making us sick.
Yeah, I think unfortunately you know, part of climate change, part of the way in which we've been growing as a humanity, increasing our population size, the way in which we are demolishing the forests where the animals, you know, live. And it's led to this whole concept of One Health, that, you know, whatever we are, plants, animals, insects, fish or humans, we share one world. And we have to find a way in which we live with each other in harmony,
and
that
way.
We protect each other.
Final question quickly. The president hasn't spoken yet. It feels like they are lingering a bit. What are your expectations, or what do you know about lockdown talks or presidential speeches and stuff like that? What can we expect?
I have no idea. Now that I'm no longer on the Ministerial Advisory Committee, I have no idea what's going on at that level.
Professor, always great catching up with you. Thank you for your time. I know it's precious. Love to you and your family, and thanks for the chat.
Absolute pleasure, Martin. All the best.
Thank you, Professor. Bye-bye. Professor Salim Abdul Karim there. If you want to hear any of that again or share it along, we'll pop it on to Audio On Demand on jacarandafm.com.
Breakfast with Martin Bester.
Every morning.
From 6 to 9 a.m.
I love it.